Right now, like as you listen to this, your device is catching thousands of chopped up, totally out of order pieces of data flying blindly across the world.
Yeah, and it is frantically gluing them together in real time, just so, you can hear my voice.
Exactly. I mean, you and I interact with technology every single second of our lives. But if you're like most people, the actual plumbing of the digital world, like
Yeah.
how it works, where it breaks, who it actually leaves behind, is basically just magic.
Right. It's a black box.
Yeah. So today, we are taking a look at a really unconventional treasure trove to kind of demystify that magic.
We are looking at the official notes and rationales from an AP Computer Science Principles Practice exam.
I know. It sounds like a flashback to high school, but trust me on this. We are not here to memorize textbook definitions.
Definitely not.
We're going to use this curriculum as a shortcut. I mean, it is specifically designed to take a complete novice and turn them into someone who truly understands the hidden digital infrastructure running our lives.
Yeah, it's surprisingly rich material.
It really is. So our mission today is to grab those underlying, like, aha moments, leave all the dense academic jargon behind, and make you the most well-informed person in the room when it comes to the screens you stare at every day.
Because it breaks down incredibly complex foundational concepts into these bite-sized rationales. Instead of just listing what a computer does, it actually forces you to look at the why and the how of systems we take entirely for granted.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we can understand how all this technology actually impacts us, we have to understand the ground we are standing on.
Yeah.
Like, how does information actually move?
Right, the infrastructure.
Yeah. And looking through these notes, the very first thing I realized is a distinction I have been getting wrong since, like, the 1990s. The difference between the internet and the World Wide Web.
Oh, yeah. That's a huge one.
I honestly thought those were just two interchangeable terms for the exact same thing.
You're definitely not alone in that. I mean, people use them interchangeably all the time, but they are fundamentally different layers.
How so?
Well, the internet is the actual physical and logical infrastructure. It is the global system of interconnected computer networks.
So, like the actual cables.
Exactly. We're
Yeah.
talking about the physical fiber optic cables running under the ocean, the copper wires, the routers, and they all use standardized open protocols to connect devices worldwide. It's literally a network of networks.
And the World Wide Web is, wait, what is it then?
The web is just an information system. It's, the pages, the programs, the files that you access over the internet.
Okay, let me make sure I'm visualizing this correctly.
Yeah.
Is it like, okay, is the internet like the physical roads and highways? Like the asphalt, the bridges, the stoplights?
Yeah, that's a great analogy.
And then the web is just the shops, the houses, and the billboards built alongside those roads.
That is the perfect way to look at it. You use the roads, the internet, to visit the shops, which is the web.
Correct.
But the roads exist entirely independently of those specific shops. Like, you could use the internet to send an email or transfer a raw data file or make a voice call without ever opening a web browser or touching the World Wide Web.
Oh, wow. Okay, so if the internet is the highway, how do our cars, like our data, actually drive on it?
Carefully
Yeah.
and chaotically.
Because reading these exam rationales, I found myself getting a little stressed out by how chaotic the mechanism actually is.
It's definitely not what people expect.
Right, because when I'm streaming a movie, I always picture it as this smooth, continuous pipeline of data, like a water hose pouring directly from a server into my living room.
Yeah, throw that image completely out.
Really?
Completely.
Yeah.
The data is absolutely not sent as one continuous stream. It is chopped up into tiny discrete pieces called packets.
And from what I read, those packets don't even travel together.
They don't. When you request data, say, loading a web page or streaming this very audio, the file is broken into packets and those packets are just launched out into the network.
Just fired off.
Pretty much. And
Thank
they don't necessarily take the same route. Packet A might go through a router in New York while packet B gets bounced through Chicago.
But wait, why on earth would they do that?
Yep.
I mean, if they're all going to the same house, why wouldn't they just follow the leader on the fastest road?
Because the fastest road changes every millisecond. The internet is essentially a massive web of physical routers playing a high-speed game of hot potato.
Ah, potato.
Yeah, every time a router gets a packet, it looks at current traffic. If the path to New York suddenly gets congested or, a backhoe accidentally cuts a fiber cable in Ohio,
Which happens.
it does.
Yeah.
The router instantly says, "Nope, sending this next packet through Chicago." They are constantly evaluating the landscape.
Which means they travel along entirely different paths and they might arrive completely out of order.
Exactly.
Like packet Z might show up before packet A, and my phone just has to catch them all and reassemble them like a jigsaw puzzle in real time.
Or some might not arrive at all.
Wait, what?
Yeah, and your device has to frantically send a message back saying, hey, I'm missing packet 42, send it again.
That is insane.
Actually, there's a related concept here that the curriculum mentions called lossy compression.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Sometimes, to make all the transmission faster, the system just permanently discards some of the less important data.
It just throws it away.
Yeah. We shrink the file size by throwing away bits of information we think the human ear or eye won't notice.
Wait, really? So we're just permanently deleting parts of the file so it fits on the road better?
We do it all the time. It's why a photo might look a bit blocky if you text it on a bad connection.
That is wild. But getting back to the packets, honestly, throwing chopped up data to the wind and hoping it glues itself back together sounds insanely fragile.
It sounds like a disaster waiting to happen.
Yeah. How does the internet not just collapse every 5 minutes under that kind of chaos?
Well, it sounds chaotic, but that chaos is the brilliant design of the system. It's built on a concept called fault tolerance.
Fault tolerance?
Right, which is achieved through redundancy. Because there are so many different overlapping paths in this network of networks, if a particular device or a connection fails, the whole system doesn't go down.
Okay, so the packets are like commuters using a navigation app on their phones.
Good analogy.
If there's a massive pileup on the main highway, the app just automatically reroutes everyone through the side streets. The commute might take a tiny bit longer, but nobody's permanently stuck.
Precisely. And because the internet relies on open, non-proprietary communication protocols, it is infinitely scalable.
Like anyone can join.
Exactly. Anyone can plug a new router into the network, and the system just recognizes it as a new side street. The redundancy actually requires more resources and creates longer paths sometimes, but it guarantees that the system is robust.
Okay, so the roads are highly resilient.
Very.
But that brings up an entirely different anxiety for me.
Oh, boy.
Because if we're playing hot potato with our data, right, bouncing it across these public open networks and side streets, I mean, it feels incredibly vulnerable.
Oh, absolutely.
How do we keep anyone from just looking inside the cars as they drive by?
So this is where the curriculum dives into the illusion versus the reality of cybersecurity.
The illusion. I like that phrasing.
The notes highlight several major vulnerabilities that bypass what we usually think of as security. For instance, rogue access points.
Okay, I found this part terrifying. A rogue access point is essentially a fake Wi-Fi network, right?
It is a wireless access point that gives unauthorized access to secure networks or intercepts data on public ones.
So like at a coffee shop?
Yes. Yeah. Imagine someone sits in a coffee shop and sets up a Wi-Fi hotspot on their laptop and they just name it coffee shop free Wi-Fi.
And because my phone is just looking for a familiar name, it automatically connects to the stranger's laptop instead of the actual cafe's router.
Yep. And suddenly all those packets of data you're sending out.
All my chopped up cars.
Right. They are passing directly through the attacker's machine. They can intercept and analyze everything you are doing.
But wait, let me stop you there. Because I have an insanely strong password.
Most people think that saves them.
Right. I use a password manager. It's 20 characters long, a mix of numbers, symbols, random words. Does that protect me from a rogue access point?
Mm-hmm.
Or what about keyloggers?
What's fascinating here is how fundamentally misunderstood passwords really are.
Yeah.
A strong password, one that is easy for you to remember but difficult for someone else to guess based on public knowledge, only stops someone from guessing.
Just guessing.
It does absolutely nothing against a keylogger.
Just to clarify the mechanism for the listener, a keylogger isn't someone guessing.
Right.
It's a piece of malicious software that somehow gets onto your computer, maybe hidden inside a file you downloaded or a link you clicked, and it literally records every single physical keystroke you make.
It's just watching you type.
Wow.
If the keylogger is on your machine, it doesn't matter if your password is 50 characters of gibberish. The attacker just receives a text file showing exactly what you pressed.
That is so unsettling.
The same goes for a phishing attack, where a fraudulent email tricks you into typing your password into a fake website. A strong password doesn't help if you voluntarily hand it over to the thief.
Right, so passwords are basically just one tiny, easily bypassed deadbolt on the front door.
Pretty much.
How do we actually fix this? Because the notes point heavily toward multi-factor authentication, or MFA.
Yeah, MFA is a massive step up because it requires several separate categories of evidence.
Separate categories.
The curriculum breaks it down, right? A password is something you know. But MFA pairs that with something you have, like physical possession of your specific mobile phone, or something you are, like your fingerprint or face scan.
Oh, I see. So even if the keylogger steals the password I typed, the attacker in another country can't log into my bank because they don't have my physical phone in their hand to receive the push notification.
That's the mechanism, yeah. But that still doesn't solve your earlier question about the packets bouncing around the open network.
Right, this coffee shop scenario.
If your data is passing through a rogue access point, how do we stop the person running that point from just reading your private emails as they pass through?
Right. We use encryption.
Exactly.
And the AP curriculum highlights a critical distinction between two types, symmetric encryption and public key encryption. Now, I understand symmetric encryption was like having a single key that both locks and unlocks a box.
Right, which works great in theory, but consider the logistical nightmare.
Okay.
If I want to send you a securely locked box over the internet, I use my secret key to lock it. But when you receive it, how do you open it?
I would need the key.
Yeah.
Which means I have to send you the key over the very same open, vulnerable highway we are trying to protect.
Exactly.
And if a rogue access point intercepts the key while it's in transit, the lock is completely useless.
This is why public key encryption is one of the greatest mathematical achievements of the digital age.
Really?
It is the absolute foundation of secure internet communication. It doesn't use one key. It uses two paired keys, a public key and a private key.
Okay, I struggled with this one. How do you lock something with one key, but you can't unlock it with that same key? That sounds logically impossible.
Think of it this way. What if I gave you an open padlock? Just the padlock, completely unlocked. And I kept the only physical key to that padlock in my pocket.
Okay, so I have your open padlock. I put my private message into a strongbox, and I use your open padlock to snap it shut.
No.
And once I snap it shut, even I can't open it again.
Not even you. You just hand out those open padlocks, the public key, to everyone in the world. Anyone, anywhere can put a message in a box, snap your padlock shut, and send it across the chaotic internet.
And I can't open it. The coffee shop guy can't open it.
Right. If a rogue access point intercepts it, all they see is a locked box.
Yeah,
the only person in the universe who can open it is the person holding the private key, which never leaves your local machine.
That is brilliant. It allows completely secure communication over an entirely public, vulnerable network.
It really is elegant.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. We have the network, right? The chaotic roads. We have the security, the public key padlocks, keeping the data safe in transit.
Yep.
But what about the computers themselves, the actual physical boxes doing all this math? I always grew up assuming a computer is basically a perfect, infallible calculator.
Oh, definitely not.
Right. But the source material dives into these fundamental mathematical limits that cause the machines to make truly bizarre errors.
They are machines of pure logic, sure, but they are still bound by the physical limits of their own architecture. They aren't magic. The best example of this from the text is the overflow error.
This one requires a bit of visualization. So computers use bits, ones, and zeros to represent digital data. And a computer allocates a fixed physical number of bits in its memory to store a specific value, right?
Correct. Let's imagine a computer is counting something, and it only has a limited number of bits assigned to hold that number. As the count goes up, it uses more and more of those available bits.
Makes sense.
But eventually, it reaches the absolute maximum value that those specific physical bits can represent.
And the strange part is what happens next. When it exceeds that maximum, it doesn't just stop. It overflows.
Yeah.
The notes say it literally wraps around to a negative number. Why does it do that?
A good way to visualize it is the mechanical odometer on an old car. You know, the physical dials that roll up as you drive?
Yeah, yeah.
If the odometer only has 6 digits, what happens when you drive exactly 1 mile past 999,999?
All the physical dials roll over forward and it clicks back to all zeros.
Exactly like that. In a computer, when you add one to the absolute maximum binary number it can hold, all the bits flip back to zero. But computers use the very first bit in a sequence called the sign bit to simply indicate whether a number is positive or negative.
Oh, I see where this is going.
When the binary odometer rolls over, it accidentally flips that sign bit too. So an impossibly high positive number suddenly reads to the computer as a massive negative number.
And this isn't just theory, right? I looked this up after reading the notes. In 1996, the European Space Agency launched the Ariane 5 rocket. It was a billion-dollar project.
What?
And less than a minute after launch, the rocket's computer tried to stuff a 64-bit number into a 16-bit space.
And boom.
Literally.
Yeah.
It triggered an overflow error. The computer got entirely confused by the sudden negative numbers, and the rocket literally tore itself apart in midair.
A perfect, terrifying, real-world consequence of a physical computing limit. And beyond physical limits, there are actually logic problems that computers simply cannot solve. The curriculum calls them undecidable problems.
Wait, I thought the whole point of an algorithm was that if you give a computer enough time, it can solve any math problem.
Not quite. An undecidable problem is a specific type of logic problem for which absolutely no algorithm can be constructed that will always provide a correct yes or no answer for all instances.
Never.
Never. The famous one is the halting problem, essentially asking a computer to analyze another program and determine if it will eventually stop running or run forever. It's a mathematical certainty that some problems are simply beyond algorithmic perfection.
So what do human programmers do when they hit an impossible problem? Like, just give up.
We compromise. We use heuristics.
I wanted to talk about this. Heuristics.
A heuristic is an approach to problem solving that says, I cannot find the exact perfect solution in a reasonable amount of time, so I'm going to create a shortcut to find an approximate solution that is good enough.
We trade perfection for speed.
Exactly.
Give me a real-world example of that.
Think about a delivery service trying to map out a route for a truck that has to stop at 50 different cities.
Okay.
Finding the absolute mathematically perfect shortest route among millions of combinations would take a computer thousands of years to calculate.
Just because of the sheer number of options.
Right. So instead of perfection, a heuristic uses a set of rules to find a very, very good route in about 3 seconds.
It's pragmatic. We settle for good enough.
We have to.
And speaking of trying to get things done faster, I want to talk about parallel computing. This is the idea that to speed up a computer, you just give it multiple processors to execute tasks at the same time. But the notes point out a major limitation here, too.
The limitation is that the efficiency of parallel computing is strictly capped by the sequential portion of the solution. You can't just throw an infinite number of processors at a problem and expect it to get infinitely faster.
I was trying to make sense of this, and I think I've got it.
Let's hear it.
Let's say you're baking a cake. You can bring in multiple chefs representing multiple processors. In parallel, Chef A can chop the strawberries, Chef B can boil the water, and Chef C can preheat the oven all at the exact same time. That saves a ton of time. But no matter how many chefs you cram into that kitchen, you simply cannot put the cake in the oven before the batter is mixed.
Right.
Some steps absolutely must wait for the previous step to finish.
That is the sequential limit. If a computation relies on the result of the previous computation, all the extra processors in the world just have to stand around and wait. It proves that throwing more hardware at a problem doesn't erase fundamental logic constraints.
So what does this all mean? We've talked about the architecture of the internet, the vulnerabilities of our security, and the physical limitations of the machines.
The nuts and bolts.
Right. But this brings us to what I think is the most important part of this deep dive. Computers aren't just doing math in a void. Humans are designing these heuristics, humans are writing this code, and humans are the ones experiencing the consequences.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, every piece of technology reflects the humans who built it. And that means technology is susceptible to human flaws.
Oh, for sure.
The curriculum spends a significant amount of time addressing computing bias.
The example in the text really stood out to me. If developers are testing a new algorithm for an app, and they only test that algorithm on users who were already on the app for more than 10 hours a week, they are going to institutionalize bias right into the code.
Because a power user who spends 10 hours a week on an app does not represent the average person.
Right.
If you gather data from a non-representative sample, your algorithm will be biased toward that specific group, completely ignoring the needs, habits, or constraints of everyone else.
And let's bring that into the high-stakes adult world. If a bank trains an algorithm to approve or deny mortgages, and they only feed it historical data from affluent-specific neighborhoods,
tend to be skewed.
That algorithm will learn to reject applicants who don't fit that narrow, biased profile. You need a random, representative sample to avoid baking human prejudice into the system.
Not only that, but it goes beyond just how algorithms make decisions. It's about who even gets to interact with the system in the first place. The notes discuss the digital divide, which is the systemic gap in access to computing devices and reliable internet.
This raises a massive point about societal equity. The curriculum uses a seemingly innocent example of a company deciding to move its job application process purely online. On the surface, to a tech developer, that sounds incredibly efficient.
Oh, totally efficient. But in reality, it doesn't bridge the digital divide, it weaponizes it. Moving an essential service purely online exclusively caters to those who already have the privilege of reliable internet access and computing devices.
So it's actively excluding people.
Exactly. It essentially shuts out marginalized applicants from even getting in the door.
It solves a problem for the company by creating an invisible wall for society. And even when an app is working exactly as intended for the people who willingly use it, there are massive societal trade-offs.
Yeah.
The AP Notes highlighted a fitness app, and it was a fascinating look at privacy.
It perfectly illustrates the constant tension between desired features and privacy risks.
Let's walk through it. A fitness app wants to suggest a good running route for you. To do that, the feature requires collecting your exact GPS location data.
Makes sense.
Then, the app wants to encourage you to exercise more, so it sends you a push notification when a compatible user, another runner with a similar pace, starts running nearby. That sounds like a wonderful community-building feature.
But pause and look at the mechanism. In order to provide that fun social feature, the app is actively transmitting the physical, real-time location of complete strangers.
To other strangers.
Right. You are trading your physical safety and privacy for a gamified social feature. The curriculum forces students to ask if that trade-off is worth it.
It's always a trade-off. But the text makes sure to point out it's not all doom and gloom. When we scale human interaction through technology responsibly, we also get incredible benefits, like crowdsourcing and citizen science.
Citizen science is a beautiful use of the network. It's scientific research conducted by distributed individual amateurs, really using their own devices to contribute to a massive pool of knowledge.
The example given is having amateur bird watchers all over the world taking pictures of local birds with their phones.
Which happens a lot.
Right. And when they upload those photos, the metadata, the exact time, date, and location stamped invisibly on the image file is uploaded too.
Which means a single team of researchers suddenly has a massive global real-time database of bird migration patterns that they could never have gathered on their own. It is humanity acting in parallel.
We've covered an incredible amount of ground today.
We really have.
I mean, we started by realizing that the internet is just the physical roads for chopped up, constantly rerouting packets of data, while the web is just the storefronts we visit.
Yep.
We learned that the strongest password in the world won't stop a keylogger watching you type. But public key encryption is a mathematical marvel that lets us lock boxes without sharing the key. We explored how computers can literally roll over into negative numbers.
RIP Ariane 5. Seriously. And how human developers have to rely on heuristics, those good enough shortcuts, when perfect algorithms fail. And finally, we saw how the human element, our biases, our digital divides, and our desires for privacy and connection are actively shaping the code that runs our lives.
It really reframes how you look at the tiny glass rectangle in your pocket. But there's one final concept we touched on very briefly at the start of our conversation that I think perfectly encapsulates everything we've talked about today.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember when we discussed lossy compression?
Yes. The idea that to make file transmission faster and easier, the system permanently discards some of the original data. It throws away the nuances to make the file smaller.
Now, think about the bigger picture we just walked through. The algorithms that dictate our online lives, that decide our mortgages and curate our news, rely on heuristics approximations because perfection is mathematically impossible.
And the data collected about us by these apps is just a simplified list of tracking points, coordinates, and purchase histories. If our digital world is entirely built on approximations, shortcuts, and discarded data, isn't our digital identity really just a lossy compression of who we actually are?
Wow. We are quite literally throwing away the complex, nuanced parts of our humanity just so we fit more easily into the database.
And as we live more and more of our lives on these networks, this raises an important question. What essential parts of ourselves are being permanently left out of the file?
That is a thought to keep you up at night. Something to chew on the next time you blindly agree to share your location or accept a cookie. Until next time, keep exploring.